2-minute meditation starts now. Prayer. God,
please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the good book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I can open my mind and hear your experience of all of these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
Now, this one's called Essence. When admiring a painting, don't examine the paint. When meeting an artist, don't look at the brush. Searching for meaning in the mechanics of the cells and molecules is like trying to appreciate a painting by analyzing the paint. It might be interesting in a narrowing way, but the true point is to grasp the idea that the painting conveys. Why concern yourself exclusively with the mechanics of the situation? That is like seeking an artist's genius in his brushes. It is in the mind of the artist, not in the tools, that is responsible for the beauty of a painting. In the same way, the nature of life cannot be merely understood as an interplay of mechanistic forces. It may only be comprehended by taking in the essence behind the physics, chemistry, biology, math, and other scientific outlooks. All too frequently, we become so mesmerized by life's details that we fail to comprehend the whole. The essence of life shall never be known by a human being as long as that person seeks to observe life like a viewer and a subject. The absolutely essential nature of life can only be comprehended by merging fully with the flow of life so that one is utterly part of it. Who are the Firewatch people this weekend? Does everybody thank those people right now, please? Because these guys get to stay up all night and then show up here and try to be attentive so that you guys can get a full night's sleep and come in here and be attentive. So people or making sacrifices all around you, and you may not be aware of it. Okay? There are some people that choose to be here. There are others that are here because they have to be. But we're all here. Let's make the most of it.
All right, so we are moving from step two to step three. Let's, if you have your big book, page 60. You in trouble. You writing Bill's story. Oh, God. Who in here is familiar with 60 to 62? We all have intimate experience with these pages. Here's a question for you. Do you think the authors, a.k.a. Bill Wilson, is describing someone that is drunk or someone that is sober?
Yes.
How many believe it's sober? How many believe it's drunk? And both is not one, is not, there's no C, it's A or B. Let's do this again. How many think sober? How many think drunk? Okay. He's talking about a sober person here. I can't remember when I woke up to this, because I don't know if I made the connected those dots the first several times I took people through the book. But let's talk about these pages. On page 60, right after you read the AB, it says, our description of the alcoholic and the addict, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after the first drink and before and after sobriety made clear three pertinent ideas. Now, speaking for myself, that Tarek has conceded to his innermost self that he's an addict and he cannot manage his own life. Check. That no human power can relieve me of my addiction. Check. That God did, and I know he can because he did, and I was willing to seek him out. All right, those are A, B, and C for me. I'm convinced of A, B, and C. The funny thing, the very next sentence, that is the first part of the third step. So, I mean, I look at the third step as having four layers to it. The first layer is I have to be convinced of A, B, and C, because the big book says being convinced, so it's a conditional statement, right? Don't go any further if you're not convinced. You're wasting your time. Is really, and that's my translation. So now you're at step three if you're convinced. What is the third step? That we decide to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what the hell do we mean by that? And just what the hell do we do? So, the way I look at self-will, because I have a hard time these days, even guys that I sponsor, we rarely ever have confident conversations about, oh, so you've taken your will back. You got to turn it over again. And, you know, you're in self-will right now. I don't talk in that language because I think everything is part of God's will. Because in the way I have an understanding of it is I look at my experience, right? 12 years and 7 months ago, 12 years and 8 months ago, if someone was going to describe Tarek, they would have been, the devil's got that boy. Or they would have said, he is self-absorbed, he is self-consumed. And people in the program would have been, he's an extreme, extreme, extreme example of self-will run riot. He's living by self-propulsion. He's in constant collision with people and situations. And he is consumed in self-will. It would have been an accurate description, right? 12 years and 7 months later, I call it God's will because that was God stringing me along to my surrender. He was beating me down into a state of reasonableness. Because we talked about the great persuader earlier, but then the question you have to ask yourself is, what's, if God is everything, then what's behind the great persuader? Because Bill, how fortunate are you that God made you an addict?
Oh, buddy. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm incredibly, insanely fortunate.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I got to heaven.
Do you guys believe Bill when he says that?
No.
You know, it's interesting. You can tell when a person's close to done or done I was talking to a guy on the phone the other day, and I was telling him, you know, the little snippet of my story about the 2 weeks leading up to me being struck sober. And he kept apologizing. He's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that." And I'm like, "I am not. I am so thankful that all that terrible stuff happened to me in a very compressed period of time, such that I had to notice it. Because then life changed."
And I remember the first time he just reminded me. I mean, I remember sitting in Dante's Big Book study years ago, and he still to this day he says this in his Big Book study: "The best quality about me is I'm a drug addict. You know, the greatest gift God ever gave me was making me this way." Well, why do we say things like that? Because it delivered me. Without that, I wouldn't have been delivered to you. I was delivered to Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. And without what I described 12 years happened, and what described me 12 years and 7 months ago, how can something be self-will back then and now it's God's will? And so it makes me question if there's really a separation. We have to have conversations like that, I get it, but it simplifies life for me. Even in terms of what's going on right now in this pandemic and the things we've got going on with, like, you know, the racial tensions that are in this country. And now I am going to go speak on outside issues real quick, and I'm not going to go long, but I struggle, man, because I see that the injustice is going on in this country, and hopefully now we're getting to a breaking point where something's actually going to fucking change. And then the pandemic, it blows my mind how we're handling the situation, and I become that character defect of Tarek is always right comes to the surface. I want to argue with people, and I want to debate, and I want to show them all these articles and all this research and all this stuff from other countries and other news outlets. I'm like, don't believe the fucking media. They lie. The government lies. That's all they do. And Tarek is consumed with confirmation bias, right? Anything that proves my point, I'm sending out into the world. But the only thing that gets me to drift back into this place of being able to settle back and sort of witness without judgment is the idea that this is all God. God is everything. This is an expression of existence, an expression of God. I have these brief moments where I can observe the position of neutrality. And I'm talking, this is it's a daily struggle from the time I wake up until the time I go to bed in the world we currently live in, where I'm constantly seeing something, judging it, then there's a remembrance that takes place where I'm reminded that this is part of God. And whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and it's going to be okay. And then I'm back into the other state. Then I fall back into the acknowledgement of God in it. And it's just a constant fluctuation or flipping back and forth. But it's what makes it easier, because I can't imagine, like, I'm not on social media, and I'm thanking God every single day I'm not on social media, because I hear some stuff like people talk about. There's no way my flipping would be like, I'd flip nonstop. I'd be like out of control all day long, because 1 minute I'm looking at this and my emotions get sparked because of this moron over here. Then it's this idiot over here. And then it's the news. And then it's a family member that I think is way off. You know, it's just this practice, like these 12 steps. I don't know how I would be living in today's world without these 12 steps. I don't know. Because we are bombarded. You guys being at the bridges in the period of time that you're at the bridges, it's a degree of protection, believe it or not. You know, I'd soak this in if I were you guys, and hopefully by the time you get out of here, things are... I have a hard time saying they're ever going to be normal again, because I think the world has been altered in a significant way, unfortunately. But these practices are what keep me grounded. Right, and a lot of it has to do with this idea of the third step of, like, if I saw things in a degree of self-will, I'd have a really hard time navigating through the shitstorm that we call the world right now. I just, me personally, it gives me these brief respites of like, okay, it's going to be okay because this is an expression of God. It just is for me. The other thing that I have found very difficult is the idea of God, and that God has a plan, which is very, it's a very used statement in many traditions. Should make people feel better, right? There should be a degree of faith. There should be a degree of stability behind that. But that's not what we're seeing out in the world. And so what I've become extremely grateful about is the gift of discipline I was given around prayer and meditation and reading spiritual literature and reflecting on it. Because even though I get to, I'm existing in somewhat of a manic state right now because of the flipping I'm talking about, because of all of the information that's out there in the world right now that's being thrown at us, and not knowing what, there's nothing you can be, you don't know what the truth is anymore. And the, when I'm out in the world, the fear is such a palpable thing that you can sense when you're in the grocery store and you're in a public place. And this is a complete theory and a hypothesis on Tarek's part. And I don't know if I've got a way to test it, but we'll call it a hypothesis for now. And the hypothesis is, if people truly had a personal relationship with God, the world would not be turned upside down the way it is right now. But there are a lot of people who claim to be godly or God-centered. But what the behaviors I'm seeing out in the world do not reflect that. And a lot of it has to do with this idea, well, I mean, what do you mean I turn my life over to God and make a decision to turn my will and my life? Well, to me, the idea of self-will is this. Is Tarek only does what Tarek wants to do whenever he wants to do it, and he doesn't think about the ripple effect of what he's about to do. So let's use that as a working definition for self-will. So I want to turn that way of living over to the universe. I don't want to live that way anymore. I don't want to make decisions and not think how it's going to affect the people that are closest to me. What's the collateral damage possibility? Is anyone going to be hurt if I make this decision? Right? And so the first part of the third step is that you're convinced of A, B, and C, which we've gone over. They're really the first two steps. And then the third step has a requirement that Tarek must see, that must be convinced that any life run on Tarek's ideas and belief systems can hardly be a success. On that basis, if I continue to live a life in which I am constantly making decisions based on my beliefs and not bringing in any other outside possibility, then I'm always going to be in collision with something or somebody, even though I say my motives are good. I will try to live by self-propulsion. That means I don't stop to pause when agitated or doubtful. I don't stop to call someone to get their perspective on it. I don't take things into prayer or meditation. I just go, go, go. Autopilot. Tarek's like an actor when he lives this way who wants to run the whole show. I want to forever arrange the lights, the ballet, the sound, the scenery, the rest of the players in my own way. If my arrangements, which are you, would only stay put, if only you would do what I think should be done, the show would be great. Everybody, including me, would be pleased, and including you. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, Tarek may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, Tarek can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. And what I call that is you're very inconsistent. You're very inconsistent. And one of the most beautiful changes in my life has been I've become a consistent person. Right? I was very inconsistent prior. And the inconsistency was not just in like showing up. It was with my emotions. It was with keeping my word. It was with the degree of responsibility and integrity that I was going to display, and my effort. All of those were inconsistent prior to this process. So what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. Tarek begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself even more. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that you're more to blame than I am. I become angry, indignant, which means I believe that I've been treated unfairly, and I self-pitying. So what's my basic trouble? Wake-up call. Am I not really a self-seeker even when I'm trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of the delusion that I can wrestle satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things I want? And do not my actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Am I not even in my best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And I remember the first time I did that exercise and read it with my name in it, I started to see how that was how I showed up sober. This is how I've shown up off and on in periods of time in my since I got sober. But this dominated my way of life prior to getting sober, right? And so I start to see, like, what's going on here? Because they're not talking about alcohol anymore. Isn't that interesting? No more, they're not talking about alcohol. Let's go to page 62. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of Tarek's troubles. Hold on. What's the name of this fellowship? Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you guys think would have happened if we opened page one of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and it started out with this? Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of your troubles. Would you have stuck around if that was on page one? No. Nobody in this room would have stuck around if this was on page one. What happened is they spent 54 pages talking to you about alcohol and our behaviors around alcohol. Right? I know they're passages in there about God and higher powers too in those first 52, 54 pages. But now they're saying selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of Tarek's troubles. Tarek is driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Tarek steps on the toes of his fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt Tarek, seemingly without provocation. But invariably, Tarek will find at some time in the past he made a decision based on self, which later placed him in a position to be hurt. So you guys see that it says what goes around comes around? It says that you reap what you sow, and it talks about karma. So I've always found that quite interesting, because that's really what that paragraph's about. And so we need to talk about this concept of driven. If you look up the word driven in the dictionary, here's a definition. Webster's Dictionary: compelled or impelled to steer, to forcibly take a course of action, guided by another force. Huh. Does that imply you have a choice when you're driven? Mm-mm. When we're driven, we're consumed with self-centered, selfish behaviors. In an unaware state of consciousness, we're driven through life by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Ask yourself a simple question. Do I have areas in my life right now which I'm being driven in versus making an intellectual choice or sorting out process where I examine options and then I either accept them or reject them? You can identify these areas by looking for fear. Where are you experiencing the most fear? The lack of consideration, which is really self-propulsion, or reaction. You know, like a pinball in a pinball machine. You're bouncing from one place to the next. The greatest trick the egoic mind plays on me is convincing me that clean and sober, I'm making choices. But when I look at some of the so-called choices I'm making, they're insane. Right? Because they're not really choices, because I'm not going through an intellectual sorting out process. I'm just going. Right? But we see that as a choice. Is it? I now understand I wasn't making choices. I was being driven. There was no choice, because in self-will, quote-unquote, there is not a choice. There's only the manifestation of how I think it should look when it's done. Right? And I'll do anything to get to that end game, the end result. The concept of choice, as I've stated before, comes from a state of neutrality with unselfish motives. It's an intellectual sorting out process, and I'm presented with options, consider them, and either reject or accept them. There's a reason the authors of the Big Book don't use the word denial. I don't think it was a matter of vocabulary, but instead a deliberate effort to drive home the concept of loss of choice. Instead, the authors of the book use words like illusion, delusion, and obsession, all of which signal a low state of consciousness in which one person cannot tell the difference between what's true and what's false. In that state of consciousness, we have no choice but to be driven without any choice and most likely harming other people. Obsessions and loss of control can be experienced with more than just mind-altering substances. Ask yourself, when you're driven in life, is it possible you're experiencing an obsession and a loss of control with something else? What does your current experience tell you? You know, I sat down and I wrote that out, and I always like to read it when we get to part of this book, because to me, it's like you either live in a state of being driven or being conscious and awake and practicing or cultivating the expectancy of God's presence as you work, as you manage through the day. It was like Brandon gave the example of the phone calls he used to make where God showed up. What's he doing in that? He's cultivating the expectancy of God's presence in his life. Right? So he's putting his face on the ceiling constantly. Because that's the way he wants to live. Same thing applies here. And this is the root of our problem, right? Because if you live this way, what's going to happen? You most likely will be uneasy. You most likely will be easily annoyed with people and situations. You most likely will be dissatisfied with your life because you're constantly trying to control and manage the way it looks. You'll spend a lot of time restless. You'll spend a lot of time discontented. And you'll spend a lot of time irritable. Your personal relationships are going to have stress. Your emotions might be all over the place. You're probably going to feel useless at times because the universe is so big. It's too big to control, but we still try, right? And so that's the breeding ground for your mind to tell you, I need an anesthetic. I need the anesthetic, right? And with all that going on, you can't be conscious of the presence of God in your life, and therefore you have no effective mental defense against the first one. So we attempt the desperate experiment again because we don't want to feel the way we're feeling, and we negate our past experiences with the phenomenon of craving, and boom, we're back in the vicious cycle that we talked about earlier. So there's good news here. There is good news, because once you wake up to all of this, guess what? You're starting to see how fucked you truly are.
Doomed. How doomed you are.
I got to have some fun with this. But this is that the more helpless you feel and the more hopeless you feel in this process, you start to see how imperative it is that you seek God with the desperation of a drowning man. Right? You think a drowning man's going to question the rope that comes to him? But what do we see in the rooms all the time? We question the ropes that come to us. I don't want that one. All right? I want another one.
Do you
one.
Have anything else?
But it's fascinating when you think about it. Here's the greatest statement of hope our big book has to offer for you. Tarek, your troubles, we think, are basically of your own making. They arise out of yourself, and you are an extreme example of self-will run riot, though you usually don't think so. Extreme example. You know, that sets us apart as a distinct entity. That puts us in this little section of the world by ourselves. And this is the great... Does anyone know why I have described that as the greatest statement of hope in the big book?
Because there's no one to blame but ourselves.
Exactly. That means that the world and the people in it don't have to change for me to be okay. That means that the problem is here and the solution resides here. Otherwise, I'd be effed. Right?
If I have to fix all of you for me to be okay, I got a lot of work to do. Right? But if I can just fix me and that makes you okay, whew.
Yeah. You want to take over?
So we're at this kind of turning point, if you will. We're halfway through the third step, right? We've gone through the first step. We see how we're doomed. We see how we're fucked. right? We see how everything that we've ever tried, ever, didn't work. And we're here. We weren't sure that this power actually cared whether or not we lived or died or were sober or clean or not. But we're open to the possibility that perhaps if we seek whatever that is, that something might happen. So we've been convinced of all that stuff. The requirement is that I start to open up to the possibility that I'm actually the problem. And then we're faced with this decision. Okay? The third step decision. But yet, it goes on a little bit more in the book, and it starts talking about these relationships between us and God, right? And if you were to sit here and try to get Tarek and I to explain to you what we believe God is, we don't have enough time. Okay? So, it was funny because, you know, in Brandon's plans, he was going to grab this stack of books off his bookshelf to bring and pull things out of to share with you. And as I'm kind of going across my bookshelf and I see that there's, you know, a Buddhist book and a Hindu book and a Taoist book and another Taoist book and a book explaining Christianity from a Hindu's perspective and a belief in how your mind works, and then we've got like just this massive catalog of different things, poetry that tells about God and all this stuff that I'm going through to try to encapsulate and deliver to you that, guys, this is what God could be, right? Well, Bill doesn't have a bunch of pages, so he has this one paragraph where he starts describing relationships at the bottom of page 62. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God, because whether you know it or not, you've been doing it your whole entire life and thinking you're right in doing so. We hope that at this point in time you're convinced that it didn't work. And then it goes on to say that hereafter in the drama of life, God is going to be our director. Okay, so we had just talked about the actor. Okay, so an actor is a person that acts out a part, right? A director is the person that is in charge of directing the actor to do what the actor is supposed to do, right? So there's a relationship going on there in that description. And then it talks about he is the principal. We are his agents, okay? The principal would be a company like State Farm, right? And then State Farm hires an agent to actually sell and work with the policy, okay? So mother company has somebody that is responsible for representing them amongst the people, okay? Another relationship. Okay, and then he is the father. Do I need to describe what that is? We are his children, right? Another implied relationship of connectivity through some sort of love, and none of these relationships totally encapsulate between us and God. So I think that he used these three descriptions just to kind of get you to see it, right? Is there's a different way to understand how this relationship works with whatever that power is. And then it goes on to say most good ideas are simple, right? Whatever God is, that's good. Go with that, right? Whatever you decide. So, kind of just do another little challenge around God and maybe what God could be. So, if I were to take a tomato and I were to cut that tomato in half, is it still a tomato? Okay? And I were to take that half and I were to cut it in half, is that still a tomato? And then if I were to take that half and cut it in half, is it still a tomato? How many times do I have to cut that tomato in half before it's no longer a tomato? I mean, it's always going to be a tomato, right? Okay, so if everything originated from one source, whether you believe it's the Big Bang or it's God or it's this divine creation, originated from source, then every time that source was split into something else, we'll call it a tree, we'll call it a bush, a mountain, an animal, a person, isn't it still part of whatever it came from? So maybe if we can find that connection to source and we make the decision to reconnect with source. Because to me, that's what this is. We're making this decision to reconnect with a thing that we've not been connected with, even though we've been connected with it all the time, just not aware of it. But that's where we're at in the third step, is this desire and need to actually make a decision to connect. Okay? And then it's got these cool... You know, we hear about the ninth step promises in meetings all the time, but then they have this really cool one that's around the third step, so we're going to, just for fun, call it the third step promise. It's at the top of page 63. So when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. Well, what position are we taking? We're taking this position of a relationship with whatever God is, right? Then we had a new employer. Being all powerful, God provided what we needed if we kept God close and performed God's work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. I'm always insulted when I read that, because my plans are big, damn it. I don't have little plans, I got big plans. Our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became convinced of God's power, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Where do I get some of that dope? Right? That sounds pretty cool. So,
so when I think of birth, I mean, I can only imagine what my infant body thought of coming out of the womb in complete darkness, and then boom. Nothing but light and all these weird images I've never seen before. But there is no like cognitive thinking faculty. But I'm sure it's like fascination. Like, what is this? Right? And so we're talking about being reborn. And I think the process of rebirth requires something to die. Okay? Besides the fear of pain, there is another fear which is to be faced on the path of evolution, the fear of death. Every new form is born out of a dying old one. This process of dying to live, dying to live, dying to live, I'm emphasizing that three times, is represented by organic life all the time. Inorganic matter becomes organic by dying to itself and living a higher life in the plant, and so can the plant may be exalted into still a higher life by dying unto itself and living in the animal. The whole course of evolution is an illustration of the principle of dying to live. Can the seeker on a spiritual path easily give up the old organs in order to acquire new ones? All right. For someone in early recovery, you're dying to live, period. Right? Remember the two alternatives: live life on a spiritual basis, or die the addict death. You know, that is on page 44 in the big book. It's an important consideration. Can this seeker learn to surrender to the demand? Die before you die. Die inside this life to go on living this life, advocates a spiritual master. His view of death as a prerequisite for birth encompasses the whole range of possibilities open to him who desires to live as a true human being. The soul of such a one knows no limits. I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more I shall die as man to soar with the angels blessed. But even from angelhood I must pass on. All except God do perish. When I have sacrificed my angel soul, I shall become what no minds ever conceived. Oh, let me not exist, for non-existence proclaims in organ tones, to God I shall return. All right. So there's this concept of humanity and being a human being and being reborn to the option of becoming more human. Because I don't know about you guys, but addiction robbed me of my humanity. I was not living like a human being near the end there, folks. Look at your own experience. And so part of what has to die when I'm having this conversation with someone in early recovery is the thing inside of you that wants to do what you want to do all the time, and you're not open to the path of consideration. That's what has to die right off the rip. And that's what, if I look back at my experience, I turned myself over to this guy Randy and to this guy Dante. And as I turned myself over to them, you know, I remember thinking back on this, and it wasn't like I wanted a personal relationship with God. It wasn't like I wanted the spiritual experience. You know what was very attractive to me? I wanted a psychic change. And that was Dante's deal, psychic change. And I was like, you know what? I've lost my humanity. I don't like the person I've become. You're telling me I can have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery? Let's go for that. And so when we get to the third step, and he's talking about reborn, the promises he just read, those jumped off the page to me. But for me, there was that surrender. Like, I saw the word God, but it didn't matter what word they used there. I wanted to move forward, right? I just wanted to move forward, because that's what we're going to get into here as we come out of this third step. But you got to consider, you know, if I'm going to be reborn, something has to die. And then you have to start just the reflection in itself, and you considering it is actually working with that. And then have some dialogue about it. There's no place to get to. There's no arrival place in this. It's part of the investigation that we're talking about. And so to consider these things, right? Okay, if I'm going to be reborn, then what about me has to die? Has something died in me? Am I noticing some differences? That's all. It's just investigation. This is what's important. And as he was talking, reading those third step promises, I mean, I couldn't help but read this, because as I look back in hindsight, of course, I can clearly see what died. You know, was my need for my own plans and designs. They didn't exist. And that was new for me. Something new had been born. Because prior to, every time I'd worked with a sponsor or gotten been in a sober living halfway house or a treatment program or an IOP, Tarek always had plans and designs. I just showed up, but that was it. You know, there was something else going on in the background, and I kept picking up white chips, so I wondered if the two were connected. So,
in a mother's womb, there were two babies. One asked the other one, do you believe in life after delivery? The other replies, why, of course. There has to be something after delivery. Maybe we are here to prepare ourselves for what will be later. Nonsense, says the other one. There is no life after delivery. What would that life be like? I don't know, but it will be more light than here. Maybe we will walk with our legs and eat from our mouths. The other says, this is absurd. Walking is impossible. and we and eat with our mouths? Ridiculous. The umbilical cord supplies nutrition. Life after delivery is to be excluded. The umbilical cord is too short. I think there is something, and maybe it is different than here. The other replies, no one has ever come back from there. Delivery is the end of life, and in that after delivery, it is nothing but darkness and anxiety, and it takes us nowhere. Well, I don't know, says the other, but certainly we will see Mother, and she will take care of us. Mother? You believe in Mother? Where is she now? She is all around us. It is in her that we live. Without her, there would not be this world. I don't see her, so it's only logical that she doesn't exist. To which the other replied, sometimes when you're silent, you can hear her. You can sense her. I believe there is a reality after delivery, and we're here to prepare ourselves for that reality. Is there something else? Is there something else? Have you ever tried? Is it worth trying? What do you believe? Can you touch the ceiling or not? Is it possible? Can you find a way? So that's where we are with the decision.
Can I interject?
Mm-hmm.
So when I first started, I said there was four layers to the third step. Remember, we did being convinced of A, B, and C. If you're not, no need to move any further. Seeing the first, the requirement of this third step, which your life lived on your quote-unquote self-will, can hardly be a success, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting at the bridges. The third is the third step decision that Adam's, Brandon is talking about. And then the fourth layer is an affirmation, which he's about to talk about, which affirms the decision.
The affirmation comes in the form of a prayer. It's the acknowledgement with whatever this thing is that you trust and hope and believe, at least in small part, that it's possible. And the biggest part of the decision is that you decide to do the rest of it. I think in simplicity, the third step decision is boiled down to the agreement and decision to do steps 4 through 12. That's it. And if you can look at it as that, then when your sponsor at some point in time prods you to continue to go forward, you can look back and you decided to do this. I will go through an exercise with the guys that I sponsor where we'll get right here. I'll explain the prayer. I'll dissect it for them. And then I'll go to the last sentence of the paragraph right after the prayer. Okay, see, I kind of feel like Bill was trying to trick us into saying the prayer when he wrote this book, right? Because we got this little prayer. It says, we were now at step 3. Many of us turned to our Maker as we understood Him. Okay? I'm going to say the prayer real quick, and then I'll talk about the disclaimer, and then I'll dissect it. It says, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. And then it says, disclaimer at the end, fine print, we thought well before taking this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. Well, shit, I just said the affirmation and now you're giving me the disclaimer? You tricked me, right? So I'll take my sponsees right up to here and then I'll explain. What this third step prayer is telling you is that it's not about you at all. If you really read the words here, this is about everybody else. Okay? God, I give up being me. Okay? I abandon myself. And I'm giving up me so that you, God, can take me and use me however you want. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Get rid of me so much that I can better do what you want me to do. In that, you might take away some of my difficulties, not because it's going to benefit me, but because if you see, if others see these difficulties being taken away from me, it will be, they will witness the power that you have to take away these difficulties, and it will be a demonstration of your power and your love, and how when I'm in connection with it, I'm living your way of life. And do this just on Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays. But it actually says, may I do thy will always, right? So I love it when a guy says this prayer, and then over the next 2 weeks, shit gets real in his life. Things start falling apart. He's starting to get angry with everybody, and there's chaos coming at him, and he calls me and he wants to complain and bitch and moan that life's falling apart. And I said, good. The prayer worked. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, the prayer said, God, show me how fucked up I am so that I actually want to overcome being all fucked up so that I can go help other people. So God's just showing you how fucked up your life is. Yeah. So I always tell them when we get right here, I want you to really think about it whether or not we're going to say this prayer. Because what I've seen hundreds of times is a person says this prayer and they do nothing with the rest of the steps. And you know what happens? Chaos comes at them. Shit gets real. They stall out in the fourth step. And you know what happens 100% of the time? Gone.
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
Brandon, listening into him triggered a memory from 2014 when this guy was taking me through the steps, and we got to the third step, and he said, he asked me a question, and I mean, it's been a while, so it's been 6 years, so I'm of course paraphrasing, but he's like, so what do you think of when you think of God's will? And I said, I rattled off a bunch of really cool things.
Rainbows and butterflies and unicorns and stuff, right?
And I was married with a stepdaughter at the time. And he goes, yeah. He goes, you know, that's probably what most people think about. He goes, what if God's will is for your daughter to get cancer and die? What if God's will is for you to lose your job and your means of providing for your family? What if God's will is for your marriage to end? He rattled off a few more, like really things we don't want. It makes our assholes get really tight when we think about it. We're like, uh-uh, I don't want to think that way. He goes, your exercise is to think about all of that. Are you ready to totally abandon yourself to God? Your life is no longer your business. Are you just okay with this idea of God's will when things are good and you're getting handed all these wonderful things? But what if that's not what happens? And so I remember I sat with that exercise for a week, and we met the following week, and I said I was ready to abandon myself totally to God. And this was in I think this was like December of 2013, actually, because what happened starting in January of 2014. Shortly after I took that step and I was in the middle of writing inventory, the first thing that happened is we had a snowstorm in Atlanta and I slipped and hurt my back on the ice. And it was a pinched nerve. So anyone that has a pinched nerve, that's not fun. And then shortly thereafter, I got a kidney stone for the first time. And so I had to be put on pain medication for the first time in sobriety. And then shortly thereafter, I went in to have an MRI on my knee, and they said, hey, you got to have surgery. You'll only be on crutches 3 to 5 days. I come out of surgery, and they're like, we got some bad news. You don't have any cartilage in your right knee, and you're going to have to be on crutches for 8 weeks. Again, I'm on pain medication. I start to put on a bunch of weight. And I think my depression sort of may have started at that point. And then shortly after that, my wife at the time goes on a girls' weekend, and I had to put her dog to sleep, which was really our dog, to sleep while she was out of town on a trip.
Mind you, having to put the dog in the car with crutches and a bum knee.
Yes. I had to get a friend of mine to help me with all of this. It was horrible, right? Then our house gets broken into. My wife and stepdaughter are terrified to be in the house, and so we moved out of that house into my parents' little guest apartment that they have. So now I'm with my wife, my daughter, and my parents. Not what you want when you're 7 years sober, 38 years old, 39 years old. You know, that's not the vision we had. And then I go in to see the doctor to have some of my sinuses, and they got the camera up my nose looking at my sinuses because I got a bunch of polyps, and they accidentally took the camera too far, and he found a mass growing on my vocal cord. And so they wanted to do a biopsy because it was a big mass on my vocal cord. So I had to have vocal cord surgery, and I could not talk for a week. So I had to type into this app, and it would do my talking for me, which was actually half cool, half not cool experience, not being able to talk for a week. And then I had to have a surgery on my sinuses. All of these surgeries requiring pain medication. And then I ended up having another surgery on my lower back. And I was put on pain medication again. And my identity was stolen. I had to deal with identity theft. And I'm telling you all this because all of this shit went down. And there was a 7 month period. All of it in 7 months.
And then Callie.
Oh, and then my stepdaughter started having seizures. And you just reminded me. And so we spent 2.5 days in the hospital learning how to, you know, take care of a child with epilepsy. And that was a terrifying experience, not only for us, but for her, the little girl. And we were in, like, the ward at the Atlanta Children's Healthcare where, like, there were kids that had been burned. And, I mean, it was almost 72 hours of extreme sadness every direction you turned, right?
Let me interrupt. So, I don't want you to think that you say the prayer and this happens. Okay, God only gives you what you can handle. Period. Okay, Tarek was a lot of years clean at that time, had a very rigorous spiritual practice. So, God threw all that at him. Because God knew that Tarek could handle it. Okay? I am certain that when you say the third step prayer, all that's not going to happen to you. So don't start going, well, shit, I don't want to say that prayer now after hearing that.
Keep going. The irony is the exercise that Bob had given me was thinking about all those negative things about God's will. And look, I mean, I'll never forget, and I forget what point this was at. This was sometime, all this started in January. This was around like May or June. I put on a bunch of weight. And I was 25, 30 pounds heavier than I am now. And I went to put on one of my favorite shirts, and I couldn't put it on. And I turned into like the Incredible Hulk, and I ripped this shirt off of me. I told God to suck my, you know what? I was like, F you. I've done all, and I'm like having this audible conversation with this power, which I think is cool because I'm still communicating with God, right? I mean, this is part of it. And I think it's super cool that I can have that type of relationship with my higher. It wasn't like I was abandoning God. I was more like, what the F? You know, I've done all, I mean, I do these things to carry a message, to help your kids when they're suffering, all these things I'd learned to say. And I remember walking out of my bathroom after I ripped that shirt off, and I dropped to my knees, and I said one of the most sincere, most authentic prayers I've ever said, which was, God help me. God help me. Emotional as hell. And just sitting there with like this shirt hanging off of me. I just laughed even thinking about it. But I think there was a gift in all of that because I've seen people in my 12 and a half years, and I'm not saying I'm special by any stretch. I'm acknowledging a gift because I've seen people go through much, much less, and they don't turn to God. They get taken a completely different direction. And so what happened was I began to acknowledge that God's will was not all love and light. You know, but what God's will always was for some of us was a sign of I need God. I needed God in that moment, and He was there. What at first was a flimsy reed had proven to be the loving and powerful hand of God in the middle of the shitstorm. And so what I found was I was seeking refuge from God in God. That's an interesting place to be. And so I share that story with you because the big book promises it. You know, on the bottom of page 12, I think, Bill Wilson says that in order for us to survive the trials and low spots ahead, we must perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. So what's happening here is, I don't know if this is happening, but I want to make sure that it doesn't happen. There's no way I survived that experience without having a disciplined prayer and meditation life, a group of men around me that knew everything going on in my life, taking a few guys through the 12 steps at that time, and I'd made almost all the amends. It took me 8.5 years, and I think I was getting close to having made, you know, approached all the people I was consciously aware of that I owed amends to. So I don't want you to think Tarek's just running along, going to a few meetings a week, and he has this experience and he's able to somehow navigate through that. No. Like Brandon said, there was a massive commitment to do this work. But, you know, trials and low spots are a real thing. I'm not going to get to it maybe later in the day, I will, but there was other stuff that happened to me in 2017 that paralleled what I just described to you. So I'm not giving you that description to scare you. I'm just saying, don't always think that God's got to be love and light and creator. There's the other end that holds the whole universe together, which is the destruction and the hate and the darkness. Unfortunately, they're part of this existence. When I'm able to see that all of God is encompassed in all of that, I don't sit in judgment of what I'm watching play out in the world right now as long. I can't tell you I don't sit in judgment because I sit in judgment every single day. But I drift from non-judgment to judgment, from non-judgment to judgment. And that's what's really important. Does that make sense?
So I described to you that the farm that I live on and all the animals. And some of the coolest spiritual understandings have happened as a result of interacting and watching these animals. But you know, as... if anybody knows anything about the way that a flock of chickens is there's a pecking order, and that's a real thing, right? And it starts with the roosters, okay? So there's the main rooster, and literally he crows first, okay? And if there's another rooster in that coop, the other rooster knows that he crows second, okay? Now, these guys are constantly in a battle for the top spot, right? And on my farm, there's this little wiry kind of Mountain Dew drinking Camaro driving chicken named Jasper. And then there's this big broody one called Shemp, right? And you look at him and you think, Shemp's going to kick Jasper's ass. Jasper's too quick. Gets him, right? So Jasper crows first and then Shemp reluctantly crows second. It's kind of like, and then it's like, motherfucker, cock-a-doodle-doo. You know? But so, like, and the same thing with the hens is, like, where the hen gets on the roost, which nesting box she gets, all that stuff is determined by pecking. Okay, so it's fascinating to watch this, right? Well, so we let the chickens out. We rotate coops and we let them go wander around. And, you know, Chubb's pretty smart. He, like, waits until Jasper's, like, way the hell over by Bill. And he's like, I'm going to get myself some. So he goes over and he goes to mount one of them. And I mean, it's a violent thing. His beak grabs onto the back of her head. He pins her down and starts going to town for about 2 seconds. And then all of a sudden, Jasper comes running over from way over by Bill and just whacks the shit out of Shemp right off the hand, right? And then their hackles come up, and these two guys, they go at it. They're just battling because Shemp's like, I want some too, motherfucker. And Jasper's like, these are my hands, motherfucker. And they go at it, right? And sometimes they get bloody and they lose feathers. And, you know, as farm dad, I'm sitting there going, guys, stop. Right? I don't want them to be doing that to each other, but you know what? They're just acting like chickens. And they're just doing what they do. So the reason why I tell that story is because it's like, to me, like God sees all this fucked up stuff that we're doing. God's just farm dad. He's like, oh, there's Shemp on top of Bertha over there. Here comes Jasper. There's going to be trouble. And you know what? They go at it. I hope nobody dies. And I still love them, and I still put them up, and I still feed them, and I still protect them. Okay? And that's, to me, kind of like how God is when he sees stuff. He sees us making mistakes, and he's just like, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. Oh, he did it. Okay, shit's going to happen. Right? And so we always look at it from the perspective of we think that God's this force that's going to stop us from screwing up or experiencing any negative stuff. Sometimes we have to. And that's the purpose of it. It's the purpose of existence. It's the continuous cycle of things. Right? So, all right, I don't think that we need to think well about it unless you want to. But I think that before we break for lunch, correct?
Mm-hmm.
If you guys would be willing to, let's look at page 63. And let's say the prayer. You can do it on your knees. You can do it sitting where you are. You can do it however you want. And then we'll be silent for a couple minutes and pay attention to the reverberation of energy in the room and how we're all just super peaceful as a result of actually affirming what we're doing here. And then we'll take a break for lunch. So, God,
I offer myself to thee. To do with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of bonds yourself, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those thou wilt. Thy power, thy love, thy way of life, that I be thy will of all answers.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. 2 o'clock.